So I'd like to do, describe a little bit about some motivation essentially arising from quantum gravity phenomenology, and then I'll describe something along the lines of quantum geometry phenomenology. Just to remind you, I'll discuss the whole very quickly, something about dispersion relations, and this will be, I think, brought up again at the end this morning. The model, and hopefully, this time allows to discuss a little bit about understanding the parameters of the model using tests of local recurrence. So, the first thing I wanted to discuss is just ask, can it be done? That's to say, can we do quantum gravity phenomenology? It's something that, growing up in the community of quantum gravity, seemed like something that was utterly hopeless, that it's a matter of trying to find effects in the Planck scale, and the Planck scale so remote that it would just be utterly inconceivable that we might discover something. Well, that has changed over the years. I offer one possibility, which is only, of course, motivated. We certainly don't have a nice connection between a full theory of quantum gravity and, in fact, any sort of phenomenology. But I offer just a one example here of, well, maybe it can be done. So one possibility is that you might consider a Planck scale suppressed correction term to the dispersion relations. It's a radical thing. It's induced with the first grade, whereas invariance is broken. So just as an example case, I'll consider a model where there's separate parameters here, kappa, which are two parameters or more, or QED, and then some hadronic parameter. And I'll just essentially mention that particle threshold kinematics is highly sensitive to these sort of effects, these cubic corrections is default. And in fact, current astrophysical observation severely constrains these parameters. So I'm not going to give any details. This is a motivational thing. But let me just say a couple things about where we are right now. First of all, there are constraints in the theoretical side, looking at effective field theory. And one can see that one needs to consider felicity in the QD sector. Also, there's spectacular constraints coming from empirical analysis of cyclotron radiation coming from supernova remnants, as well as gamma ray burst and dispersion effects. And then we also have, so on the theoretical side again, a fine tuning problem, as to say, what looks like the effect that should be suppressed by the Planck scale effects. When you remove calculations, the constant of order 2. So this reduces essentially to, in a very loose sense, that the theoretical framework seems sketchy, not well founded. Another perspective, though, which is completely different, however, and I just write it out as an intriguing possibility. So Giovanni and Emilia has suggested that we should be using field theory considerations at all. That's to say, we're sort of looking at constraints from two sides. One is sort of astrophysics observation, another is theoretical constraints. He's just posted a paper recently suggesting, no, let's not use effective field theory. Okay. So let me just go look at the pair of parameters for QED and see where we are. This is the work of the JLM or JLMS collaboration, JJC Lindbrock and Mattingly. So this, what we see here is that this is a log plot of those parameters. It was originally thought that if those parameters weren't around the order 1, that these terms were effectively ruled out. You can see here we're looking at parameters that are much more severely constrained than that. So it's looking like there isn't even just from a theoretical, an observational perspective, it looks like these are severely constrained tracks that are going to be unnatural, so it's just looking at higher orders or something else, or that is just wrong. But just to say that the case is certainly by no means closed, let me just draw your attention to a paper that was posted in January of last year. We looked at the reanalysis of the cosmic ray spectrum at high energy, so it's a log x plus of events. This is the energy scale, starting at 18.5 and 20.5. So it's the top end of the cosmic ray spectrum. The top end is Agassiz data, that's the red. The bottom is high-res data. This analysis done by DeMarco et al. And this is the reference. And I drew a line here to emphasize that this is the expected GTC cutoff. we have events up here where we don't know what's going on. If you're not familiar with the GPK cutoff, what that is an expected result coming from cluster relativity, which is that if you have high energy particles coming from cosmological distances, then you expect they would interact with the cosmic microwave background and lose energy. So you'd expect a cutoff flip from the spectrum right here. So this is a completely controversial situation right now. The good news is that we have more data coming along. We need more statistics. There's an expert present at this board. There's a presenter built by a Japanese collaboration to do cutoff. But there's also one being built and already taking data with the OJ project.
And these two sets of points are supposed to be giving the same curve?
Yes. And actually, I want to say a lot of things, but these two different types of effects, one of the issues is a calibration issue. Okay. So that's one of the issues that people have. Yeah, that's right. I mean, if I may, there are some rumors in the OJ. In fact, I believe the highway collaborators actually decided that they need to raise their curve because of calibration issues. But that'll all come out as the data comes to them. So, anyway, what was the point of that little motivational piece? The motivational piece was that apparently Pentagon maybe is not worth staying in events and saying, quantum gravity is not something that we're going to see in our lifetimes, but we might, in fact, start the steps towards building phenomenological models which could bridge the gap, potentially, between physics that we see and physics that we do on paper. So, obviously, the key thing here is the growth of the horizon curve. So, essentially, we're not looking at sort of nice, pure quantum gravity effects in some sense, we're looking at special relativity and changing the nature of that. So I'd just like to, Ms. Marks suggest looking at something else, which is breaking the rest of our experience anyway. Let's look at spatial geometry. Let's look at breaking these main hooks here, but it's not really quite breaking. But we need to look potentially, or it's potentially worth looking at what happens if you look at the spatial geometry rather than some boost effects. The curious thing about this is that there's no natural scale. This is for potential. There's no natural scale associated with this effect. So, it's perhaps something that is easy to constrain. Okay. So, just as a pair of examples, we've seen the area spectrum over and over. This is, of course, a simplified version. I draw your attention to two things. So, this is from the quantum gravity study. One is that there's this light scale here in the area spectrum, and that, of course, plays a huge role in any kind of effect that you might expect from this operator. Okay? Another possibility is an angle operator. This is an angle operator based on the construction that Roger Penrose used many years ago. And I just point out one thing, that there's no scale associated with this effect. And let me just plot for you the spectrum. If you're interested in details of that, I can show you, but again, this is just motivational stuff at the moment. So, if you look at the spectrum of that operator, what I'm graphing is looking at the angle of the horizontal axis and then the total spin of the vertex. This is the basis of the vertex, just like the volume operator, not on edges, ever. And if you just look at studies of a single vertex, they're very limited heuristic studies. What's interesting, though, is that you notice that you only start to approximate classical angles that we would like to know above at spins of 10 to 20. This is a huge value for spin. And it would involve, presumably, a lot of curvature at that point. So what we'd like to do is use this as motivation for thinking about the possibility of looking at spatial, discrete spatial geometry and seeing if we can try to limit those effects or constrain perhaps parameters of the phenomenological model. So I'm going to present a model which is based on two assumptions. One is that the underlying, whatever the underlying theory is, it has a discrete structure in terms of the spatial geometry. And suppose it might be some sort of graph kind of basic state or spin network state. The second assumption is based on some Malthusian ideas. And here I just have a quote from science and mechanics, which is a sort of quite lovely one in the sense that it suggests that if you are looking at the motion of any object, it only makes sense if you look at that motion relative to another object. Sort of a very obvious thing, but of course when you're critiquing Newtonian absolute space, it's a very key thing. But I use that as a motivational point of view, is that what we need to do is consider the possibility, and this is an old idea again, that inertial mass, in fact, is determined by the total mass distribution of the universe. So let me remind you of some work that's quite old at this point, but I actually quantitative formulation of this. This is due to Petronian Saltpeter in the late 50s, allegedly experiments from the huge Bigger experiments in the early 60s, which are still being pursued today, something I use. Okay, so the idea is that if you have a critical mass, which depends on the total mass distribution, then because of the position of mass non-uniformities in the universe, you're going to see an effect, an anisotropic effect, in the inertial mass itself. So here's what they had for an idea. That's to say that the inertial mass itself is determined by the total mass distribution and then scaled by some power of R, this is the wave. And in fact, that anisotropic effect depends on an angle, which is between the acceleration and the third direction. Let's say the direction towards the non-uniformity of the matter. So the idea they had, they already started constraining models in that paper, and that's since led to a lot of work. And the idea is that if you're careful about how that angle of dependence should arise, then what you see is that if you look at an experiment, especially something involves, say, Siemens transitions, then the structure of those transitions, that's to say, the energy levels, will get shifted as time goes by. So if you have an experiment sitting in the lab, and you take this, if you look at the transition energy for a Siemens transition at some point in the day, then say the third vector is pointing this way, then as the day goes on, this third vector will apparently trace out a path in your non-inertial reference frame. Of course, you don't remember rotating, so that will trace out a variation. And so what they did in that paper was to point out, well, we've looked at high precision, as for instance, say, lithium, with a nuclear revolution. But no one has looked at this data over any period of time. So maybe we can look at this data over a period of time, in fact, constrain the possible effect. And the key thing they pointed out is that not all transitions are affected equally by the way they orbit the tunnel, such as this angular thing. And so what happens is you can use the transition as a reference for, in more modern terms, you can just compare two different atomic systems or nuclear systems and see the potential look for a drift in the relative change in the energy levels. So that was old work, but on the other hand, it's still being used as a motivation factor for experimental work. In modern language, we're really looking for vector extensor fields, for vector extensor fields. So I just remind you that older work, in part because my motivation is more coming from off on something else. Okay, so in particular, say, broken symmetry is straight. Okay, so if you have non-uniformities in the matter of distribution, these will cause variations in your energy levels. And so essentially what we have is a local for corrections. And the next part of this is that local discrete random, discrete geometry, or discrete random geometry, cannot support this continuous angle. So that's to say, if you have an angle of a third direction, then as time goes on, it can't continuously smooth out a path, but rather it will actually have to jump around. So this is the hypothesis or assumption of this model, is that we look at deviations from this direction, and we're going to say that any of them are equally likely. And so, and they don't depend on what the direction was a moment before. So essentially what happens is that we have a preferred direction that takes a random walk, and then on the scale that we've done the experiment, this is the diffusion process, in this case the direction. So that's the idea. Now, from that first assumption, as I said, space geometry is discrete in some sense. Right? And this automatically means that there will be violations of the weaker Hilbert principle and local Lorentz invariance. That suggests that, this is work, older work from just looking at the foundations of the PR, that we don't have this fundamental economic metric, but rather we should look for corrections in known physics, say in the drag equation, we should look for corrections which are using these kinds of effects. So here's some nice work by Mandelsall, where to look at this precise case, but not the case, as I said, the precise case of the result of x, that we're not based on the Riemann metric, so looking at that associative test as the case of the principle of local residence. But here, it's a great slot together, and that is that these are not just a set of corrections, but actually have this effect of the discrete geometry. So, particularly in random walk. There's two terms in random walk is simply anisotropic effect, and another is spin coupled. So, there's two possibilities. The first is just local resonance breaking, and then the second involves biological as well. Okay, so the idea is that what we can do is just look at normal perturbation theory in this context, and if I recall here, there's no Planck scale. There's no Planck scale in this case because there's no natural formulation for the scale of such an effect. What we're getting, though, is we're getting some sort of scale from the expected non-uniformity of the mass. So that's what we're going to use to the model. So what do you do? Well, you look at these terms as small perturbations in the usual sense of the word, and then we look at the effects on the energy levels and see what we can do. Okay, so let me just describe some parameters of the model. And what we're going to look at is going back to the Tony Saul here, the non-uniformities in the mass distribution scale by the distance away is then we give the general scale for this anisotropic effect, but then we're going to, I'm just going to have a parameter to see how those are suppressed. Since we know that the mass distribution and distance away. And then we're in this other parameter, we this new model, this new parameter, which will just give us the size of the effect. So, there's nothing solved here, so that had between 0 and 1 in the case where you didn't have this discrete geometry that's fluctuating for a direction. Okay, so what does this do? If you look at diffusion on a sphere, you get a diffusion constant which looks something like this. That is to say, you look at this parameter here, delta, which includes the granularity in the lattice size, if you want to think about it that way, of the angle, and then you have some time scale of the actual random walk itself. So those will probably not be so accessible to diffusion constants. So the idea is, can we use tests of local Lorentz invariants to actually constrain the tension of the shape? So how is it, what sort of distributions do we have in the scale of the distributions? The scale may be twofold. One is the size of the effect, that's some degree already been done, and then also the size of this diffusion constant, something testing how these vectors work. So that's the idea. So again, the Kachani-Stahl Peter launched a model, launched a couple of experiments, and then in the early 60s, and then it's been followed up since then. So these, again, was looking for Lorentz gliding effects in Tiemann transition frequencies. And so these are some of the most precise knowledge experiments ever performed, which is, of course, a nice thing if you're looking to constrain potential models of this sort. Clearly, as you all know, no spherical variation has been observed. And so modern versions, of which there are a number, often have, many of them have, sort of co-located magnetometers to track relative phases and drifts of a more frequency that occur. So here's, these are not the most recent, but some recent effects, recent experimental results limit this effect to the 10 to minus 23 level. Okay. So just as an example, for fun. This is from a paper from 1995, experiment done at Amherst College. Right here, we just have the time in hours, and they're just taking data and looking. So what they do is the number that comes out of their analysis counts first is a difference in magnetic fields. So you can change, transform these losses into a quantum, into a difference of energy. You can constrain them, delta them over and infer them. So this is sort of data that groups have, and then what they do is they look for currently, they look for just fitting a signal, a periodic signal, which is, has a period of like once in a real day, and then they look at the strength of such a thing. So you can tell that this is just, you just look at it, it's just like pure noise, no effect. And that's good, because it kind of limits the stress. It's good for us as well, because it helps us limit what the strain is in possible models. The difference now is the claim is that there's not just a single period, but one in which there is a diffusion constant. So the reoccurrence time for these experiments is no longer just precisely one serial day, but we're looking at the case where it's a little more complicated. So what we have to do is take a Fourier transform of this, and then look at the pure noise, of course, the Fourier transform is flat. So let me just plot an example here. So if the pure noise, we're going to look at something like this, and if it's not, then and this effect is real, then what you're going to have is a Gaussian distribution, something like this. And so there's two things that we can constrain using such analysis. One is, of course, the height of that peak. That's the size, that's the scale of the exact alpha. So that's, well, it's certainly, that's essentially not hard to constrain, and not hard to constrain very, very nicely. And the results are just improving day by day. The other thing is the width of this is also possible to constrain. So that's the huge constant of this. Okay. So just to summarize, this is a model of discrete Mantuan. Discrete Mantuan model to look at sort of double phenomenology, something a little different than looking at high energy physics, but in fact, this is low energy physics. And it's a model that has three parameters. The first of which can be already constrained very nicely. And as I said, this is a work, or I shouldn't say what happened in the first slide, but this work is certainly in progress. One of the things that has happened in the field since 1995, but it's field of focal Lorentz invariance test is that collaborators have formulated a standard model extension. And there, it's been wonderful for the experimental community because it's essentially provided one parameter for them to compare all the results. So it's important to look at a case where so well, it's prepared those parameters in that model. Now the difference is, of course, that's dealing with a spontaneous signature gradient case, not something that has a dimensional model like this does. So there has to be some competition. So then the other possibility is to come up with a measurement scheme for looking at more precisely, say, the scale, that was just the part, and then also the actual shape of the effect.
After the matter of the level of the narrow, wouldn't you really expect that in a free direction for a triad? Say, if you're going to be of course, say, the direction to diagonalize your mass transfer equation. And the other question is, do you have any directive? That's kind of what M of N might be, what other magnitude? So, is it 10 to the minus 22 important or not?
So, the one is the direction, right, comes from the mass non-uniformness. So depending on the scale, or the so distance scale that's small, you can then provide estimates for the slashless effects. So if in the lab you can provide mass distributions nearby, that's not hard to rule out. You can better than and then sort of other threats, so global in terms of astronomical scales, which is the direction of the galactic center, can also be looked at. And again, the strength available is very hard to prove. So I mean, it was, on that side, it's not too hard to demonstrate global scales.
So the biggest mass intermediary is the direction of the sun. Could you use this model to explain pioneer effect and what is already ruled out by the pioneer effect?
I was confused, didn't I? Because you can use some randomness, some weight and refrigerations. Well, on the other hand, because of this, we could then be dominated by the mass and isotopes. How can you see those
things? So the anisotropic effect is essentially coming from the threatening as a safe first effect. Non-uniformity from total matter is then provided for direction. So those laws are well described. So the idea that here, which is slightly different, is that any particle, small scale particle, and the reason why it makes sense to be talking about nuclear or atomic scale at all is that there is no natural max scale for its effects. So the idea is, what we do is look at ruling out potentially these kind of effects on those kinds of scales. So the randomness comes in the following way, and that is that if you have a preferred direction, then the local geometry simply do not support a continuous change of that direction. And the reason for that is that the local geometry in this idea is discrete, is coarse. So that's saying that as your experiment rotates or as the particle moves, this preferred direction just can't continuously sweep out change in angle, but in fact has to follow what it can in terms of the local geometry. So that's essentially the idea. That's to say, so that this angle will not just simply sweep out sort of a continuous thing, but in fact take a random walk or do a diffusion process in this case.
But isn't ignoring the argument made very well that one thing is the eigenvalues and another is the expectation value, which of course can change.
So again, going back to the beginning here, I'm not by any means claiming that we can go from any sort of operator or careful analysis and loop on gravity and say that we have these kinds of effects. What I'm suggesting here is that maybe it's not too early to start considering models that are somewhat in between. That is to say, look at a model where you have some sort of discrete effect, so that's what the assumptions come through this model, and see if you can constrain those. And yeah, it's by no means, I mean, the theory is certainly not anywhere at the level where we can actually very nicely bridge the gap between what is available on the astronomical scale and observationally with what's available in the full theory. That's really not there yet. However, it's not too early in some of our estimations to start looking at the potential effects.
Thank you.